My name is David Ryan. I'm the interim coordinator for Freethinkers at UU Sarasota. I would like to welcome you and thank you for responding to our invitation to attend today. Our Freethinkers briefings are evidence-based summaries of what the general public needs to know about complex issues in the fields of religion, morality, ethics, and justice. Learn, Grow, Help, and Play are ingredients in most of our programs here. The Sunday service is an opportunity to learn from the sermon, to grow inwardly through music, readings, and silence, to help ourselves by being present, which is also helpful to others, and to play through humor and laughter. Our briefing today is the first in a series of four lectures we are doing cooperatively with the Lifelong Learning Academy. Part of the Academy's mission is to expand the learning programs into the community by having free programs presented by its faculty at off-campus locations. There is information about the Academy on the back table, which you're free to take. The three remaining lectures in this series will be on March 28th, 2 weeks from today, April 11th and April 25th. After these special briefings, we will return to our first Friday schedule in May and June. Today, our speaker is Dr. Barry Bubb. He is a former family physician who specializes in medical communication and counseling skills. He is the author of numerous articles and a groundbreaking book, Communication Skills That Heal. He is also on the adjunct staff at Temple University Medical School. Today he will speak on the topic, Communication That Heals. He will spend most of the first hour with his briefing, and then we will have a question time that will last no later than 11:30. So Barry, you're up.
Thanks a lot, David, and thank you everybody who helped organize this in class at the back with the PowerPoint presentation. I'm currently teaching a course at the Lifelong Learning Program called The Art of Listening. So it's a six-week course. And you might think that because it's called The Art of Listening, I believe that listening's an art. Well, I don't believe that listening's an art. In fact, the exact opposite. You probably know that medicine, and I think I'm hearing a little echo here, so if we can tone it down. Medicine is considered to be an art and a science. You've heard that expression, right? The art and science of medicine. So it's evidence-based science, and it's craft-based art. Craft-based in that relational skills, medical humanities, communication, professionalism. These are considered to be crafts or arts. It's something you learn along the way. You're born with a gift, you learn along the way, you might get a little perfunctory teaching, but there's nothing scientific about it. There's nothing terribly skilled about it. The skill is in curing the patient. Well, that's not really true. After 30 years of practicing family medicine, it was patently clear to me that I didn't know how to listen. I didn't know why patients would suddenly leave the practice, why staff would suddenly just say, sorry, I'm not coming back to work, I've got another job. I didn't really understand people. To understand people, not diseases, to understand people, you need to have some idea of what people are and the clues they're sending and the signals they're sending. So what did I do in my usual understated way? I did a 3-year Gestalt psychotherapy training course. And I joined therapists and social workers and others, and I did that. And I applied the skills to my practice, the training that I had, and a whole new world opened up. When I moved to New York City, because for a number of reasons, including my wife had a job there, I decided that I can hear, I can listen, I can understand, but I know very little about suffering. And so what I did was, in a similar vein, I joined the healthcare chaplaincy and did a chaplaincy training course in pastoral counseling. And I discovered, wow, there's all this suffering going on in medicine. Who would have guessed? then we had this huge September 11th event. We were living in the New York City region. People brought their family members to me because surely I knew how to help them. And I realized that despite my medical training, despite my Gestalt psychotherapy training, despite the chaplaincy training, I knew nothing about major psychological trauma. Never been trained in any of this. So I studied major psychological trauma, and then, aha, what do I realize? There's a heck of a lot of psychological trauma going on in medicine, in the world of medicine. In fact, what is the number one cause of PTSD in society today? Not war, not returning vets, not terrorism, not accidents, not crime.
Sickness.
Sudden, unexpected death of a loved one. Breaking news to somebody, you have HIV, and in the old days, you will certainly die. You have cancer, incurable. This doesn't only, when somebody leaves the medical office shocked, stunned, bewildered, they are suffering from an acute stress reaction. And in some cases, and there's a lot of documentation, leads to post-traumatic stress disorder. A widow whose husband drops dead at home and, you know, is expected to move on but doesn't, is very often suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's not diagnosed. So what I realized was that this is being missed, and I began writing articles about it, teaching, and lo and behold, I realized that when I try and teach physicians how to communicate, they're not doing so terribly well. And I realize that physicians who are sued are also traumatized. Not all of them, but some, those who are susceptible. And how do you teach traumatized people to communicate? You don't. You need to work with the trauma. So I began to mentor physicians who are suffering from trauma. The highlight of my writing career, and I've written many articles, and by the way, the presentation today on laments, which talks about laments, there's an article, if you want to look up further details, if you want to do some homework, it's if you look up Medical Humanities, Barry Bubb, MD, you'll see an article on lamentations that'll fill out what I'm talking about here. But the highlight of my career was a very short letter, which is published in the New York Times. There was a complaint, an article about very poor bedside manner, and physicians were saying the reason we don't communicate is because we don't have time. It's obvious. My response to the New York Times was, here is some simple advice for doctors. Assume that every patient, unless proved otherwise, is traumatized by his or her illness. This might involve pain, shame, fear or economic loss. Your communication, verbal and nonverbal, can either add to the trauma or help heal it. The choice is yours. Let's get over with this business. You encounter a patient, you either heal or traumatize. One or the other. Make up your mind what you want to do. If you want to heal, learn how to communicate in a way that heals and doesn't traumatize. And there are some real horror stories about trauma. Now, it can be fairly simple to hear what people are saying, but actually listening is a highly skilled technical activity. You have to know what to listen for. You might consider yourselves great listeners, say, okay, give me a stethoscope, I'll hear a cardiac murmur, I'll diagnose what's going on, and I'll tell the patient what to do. It's not going to work. You've got to know what to listen for. And this isn't rocket science. What do we listen for? So we know how to respond effectively. And what we listen for are not just the words, but for clues. And people are sending out clues all the time. Next one, please. Who are these art lovers? What are they doing? New York City cops. They're in the Metropolitan Museum, and they're learning to look for clues. Next. For example, Edward Hopper, the Automat, very famous painting. What are the clues? Well, she's wearing one glove. Why is she wearing one glove? Did she just come in from the cold? What's the time of day? Is she drinking tea? Is she drinking coffee? What's her expression? What's she signaling? Is she, you know, is she anxious? Is she depressed? What are the clues? This is what police learn. Physicians could do the same. Next. So Philo of Alexandria said, "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle." Everyone you meet, no exception. Even the smiling one, even the comic who's cracking jokes, particularly the comic. Next. Suffering is universal. We're all sufferers. Get over it. Not rocket science. Next. Back. The word suffering comes from suffer, Latin. Nope, I shouldn't be signaling with my hand. Class? Yep. Can you go back? Okay. So, next one. No, I think we skipped. Can we just go back two, please? Again? Okay. Next. Next. People who are suffering express their suffering. Once again, not complicated. People who suffer express their suffering. Next. We call that expression of suffering the lament. Next. And listening, understanding, and validating the lament is what's healing. When somebody expresses their suffering, we understand what it is, we validate it, and it heals. We don't fix. Next. So the word suffering comes from the Latin meaning to bear or carry or endure. The word patient, and believe me, I haven't encountered a single medical student who knows this. The word patient means, is derived from the word to bear or endure without complaint. In other words, a patient is a sufferer. And what sufferers do is lament. Now, does everybody here have it? People who are ill suffer, their family members suffer, they express it as laments, and if we listen and understand and validate, it's very healing. In other words, the Crohn's disease you've had for 20 years, how has it affected your life? It must have been very hard for you. Believe it or not, that's healing. Next. Now, the lament may be obvious or it may be masked. It might be expressed verbally, physically, or silently. How are you doing? Oh, you shouldn't ask. You know, the husband left, the kids, the teenager's acting out. That's an obvious lament. But how are you doing? Oh, I'm fine. That's another lament. How are you doing? Wonderful. You know, that's a lament. Oh, my back hurts all the time. That's a lament. Often. So, people who are lamenting, who are traumatized, are usually isolated. There's a feeling of isolation. I'm carrying, I'm bearing all alone. But when someone listens and understands and validates, suddenly you don't feel quite as alone as you did before. Some of that burden is lifted. Next. So, you don't see a suffering person here. My wife gets into every presentation I do. I don't know how she does it. But we're at Libby's. And this was a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, I've got to bring this in. And by the way, if I trip on any of these steps, just pick me up. It's going to happen. So we're at Libby's, and we went there on the spur of the moment. It's 7 o'clock. It's March. It's high season. There's a crowd, there's a mob scene at the hostess, everybody wants a seat, and there's one obnoxious older guy who's hitting on this hostess who's like in her 20s, and he's trying to charm a table off her, And he's touching her shoulder, and he's like being cute. And she said, "We've got no tables." So she sent him to the bar. A waitress came up and said, "Mrs. So-and-so doesn't like a table. Can we have another one?" Two other people were there waiting for a table. When my turn came to ask, "Do you have a table for us?" I said, "You know, it must be really hard for you. Everybody's kind of pressuring you for a table, and obviously you're full. I guess you don't have one. Just two of us." And she said, "Well, there is one just here outside. It's a beautiful evening. It's for four, but if it's two of you, it'll be fine." Got the table. Couldn't believe it. What did I do? I recognized that in this hostess was a person. And I validated it. I made her visible. I recognized her suffering. She didn't have to say anything. It was kind of obvious. And by connecting with her, she responded in a way that you wouldn't have expected. So we had a great dinner, really recommended. Next. So everything should be as simple as possible, but not simpler, right? So let's move on. We learn this. Every medical student learns this. They write the exam and they forget it, because there's no point in learning it in the first place. It's a Krebs cycle. Any physicians here? No. Actually, it's pretty typical not to have a physician in a lecture on listening. Next. Next. So, based on the Krebs cycle, I decided to do something that would teach listening in a simple way, in a way you can remember. Trauma causes losses. Whenever someone's traumatized, there's a loss. In any number of ways. The losses can be physical, they can be psychological, they can be financial. In this healthcare system, believe me, your loss is financial. It causes suffering. You have to endure it. And when you suffer, in one way or another, it gets expressed. And there's a lament. When it's listened to, there's healing. And because life is life, there's going to be another trauma, another major stress or stressor. It's a cycle that continues all the time. Any questions about this particular aspect so far? It's pretty clear, isn't it? This could be taught at medical schools. It's not. There isn't time. Next. So, a good metaphor is a pizza. It was a healthy, whole, almost perfect pizza, but somebody went and traumatized it. Now, there's a loss there. There's a loss of integrity. And so the pizza, if it wants to be a healthy, whole, healed pizza, would have to reintegrate itself, become a smaller pizza with a little scar in it, but then it'll be healed. It doesn't usually happen. Next. So I'm here to tell you a story. And this is what this is all preamble. But you know the theory now. Now we're going to go into the story. Next. My daughter is a very well-known artist, teacher, and one day we speak on the phone, and she says, "Pops," she's in Seattle, and I'm in Philly, and she says, "There's a painting at the National Portrait Gallery. It won a prestigious award. I'd like you to take a look at it if you're in the city, in Washington." So, of course, I happen to be in Washington not much later than a few weeks later, and it was still hanging. And every 2 years they have a competition. Next. Every 2 years they have a very prestigious portrait competition, probably 1,000 to 2,000 entries, of which they choose 50 finalists, which are on display, and then they get various awards. Next. This is a painting, and it got the People's Choice Award that year. Next. Second prize, also a painting, really brilliant work. Next. This is an artist who's painting the frame of, and it's a self-portrait, and in the back you'll see the casts. that students do, because he's a student in this stage, and he's painting his emergence out of art school into the real world. Brilliant. Doesn't get the top award. What gets it? Let's see. Next slide. David Lentz, Sam and the Perfect World. First prize. Is it even a portrait? Reasonable question. Next. But this is what the judges said. Perhaps the most distinctive feature of Lentz's portraits is the manner in which he evokes a sense of spirit and emotion from the individuals depicted in unusual, even beautiful environments. Next one. So here's the painting. Take a moment to look at it. I'm going to have a little water. And I'd like to know what you see. What do you see? What do your eyes notice right away?
He's looking at whoever is doing the picture.
So what's the first thing you notice? The boy. The boy. And he's looking out. What else? What do people notice? What's the first thing that strikes you? The big orb in the sky. So let's have a show of hands. Those who see the boy, you know, instantly. The first thing you see is the boy. Number of hands. How many of you see the orb, the circle, as the first? Sort of evenly matched. There are two subjects here. Your eye doesn't actually know which one is the main one. But what I found is I saw the boy and my eye moved instantly up to the orb, almost instantaneously. What else do you notice in the painting? What you see an expression on his face, and what's the expression to you? Puzzled expression on the boy's face. What else do you notice?
His vision is very good.
His vision is he's wearing glasses, and he's got like a little frown, a little eye, I think, on his forehead. A little bit. He's looking quizzically, puzzled at me, at the viewer. What else do we see? The perspective is skewed, and he's leaning forward. The fence is going backwards, and it's sort of a fishbowl kind of effect. This is a painting, by the way. It's not a photograph. This is a painting. What else do we see?
He's isolated. He's
isolated, and in fact, behind him is a fence. And he's forward. He's leaning forward in a strange sort of pose, with his hands like behind his back. He's leaning in forward, and is he inviting us in to look down into the distance? Or is the painting about him? Or is it what he's inviting us to see?
He's not inviting, he's suspicious.
He's looking suspicious. Well, so the comment is he possibly just in the way of a really good picture, and the way he's standing is interfering with a picture being taken of the place?
Looks like he's not allowed to.
I'm sorry?
Looks like he's not allowed to go into that perfect world.
He's separated, not allowed to go into the perfect world behind him. It looks like he doesn't belong there. Now, what do you think of the circle? What do you think that circle might be?
Lens flare.
Is the circle lens flare? There's a photography here. Is it lens flare?
It reminds me of the bubble that the Good Witch appeared in the Wizard of Oz.
Ah, big bubble from the Wizard of Oz where the witch emerges. I looked at it when I saw it. I was kind of, it looked ominous to me. It looked like, you know, when the sun is supposed to come to the end of its life, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and will engulf Earth. It's in like 3 billion years from now, so don't worry. But there's something weird about that circle.
I think he's turned to question, what is it?
And he's questioning. He looks puzzled. He's questioning. There's this great big circle. A few other points I want to mention. I don't have a pointer, but here are some weeds on here. Otherwise, the background is quite pristine. It's sort of very pretty, rural. There are a few houses in the background you can't see. There's one right up there. Whoops, my finger's pointing towards it. And the way it's positioned is very specific. This art is very specifically done. It's not casual. He's, you know, the rule of thirds. The boy is roughly one third to the right, a little bit more, to compensate for the fact that this big orb is one third from this side, but is much bigger. So he's positioned him in this way. Somehow the horizon cuts right through his eyes, the horizon line. And we have a painting of a little boy with a fence behind him. So next one, let's see what the author says. I'll need to step back. This is in the artist's statement. My wife, Rosemary, had just given birth to our son, Sam, and although he appeared perfectly healthy, something nevertheless didn't seem right. There was an awkward silence in the room, no words of congratulation or comments about how cute he was, even though he was cute. Next. 5 minutes later, the diagnosis was given, Sam has Down syndrome. That puzzled expression, if you look really carefully. Are you going to keep him? A nurse asked. Later that evening, someone else came by to console us. It's every mother's worst nightmare, she said. Welcome to the world, Sam. Next. In America today, perfection is highly valued. We dump loads of chemicals on our lawns to try and get rid of every weed, every dandelion. Models and supermodels are tall, impossibly fit, their clothing stylish and wrinkle-free. Next. True? They're perfect, right? Total perfection. Next. That's Goldie again with her, her red hat, which she's looking at somebody who's perfect. Next. Very cute girl. Next. Emily, 22, is a nursing student and single. She says, when people look at me, they see a healthy-looking 22-year-old. What they can't see is that my body's a war zone inside because I have cystic fibrosis. And what she has with underneath her hand is a scar. She'd had part of the left lobe of a lung removed. But what you see is perfection on the outside. Next. So this is the simplest representation of perfection. Through the ages, if you want to draw perfection, what do? You draw a circle. Why? Because every circle is perfect. Take a compass, draw the circle. Circumference can vary, but it's a perfect shape. So how has it been expressed in art? What do you see around the head of the Madonna, around the saints? A circle, a halo. And it's a universal symbol of ideal perfection and divine state. So what do we have in the painting? We have Sam, who is imperfect, and a circle that is a symbol of divine perfection.
It's also infinite, no beginning and no end.
I beg your pardon?
No beginning and no end.
No beginning and no end. It's continuous, it's infinite, and Sam is contrasted with divinity, with divine perfection. How do I know it? Because I spoke with the artist. And this was what was on his mind. But I was ruminating. I too wasn't sure. What is that orb? Is the orb maybe a sun? And the boy is a sun? And it's a sun and sun? Is the orb an egg? Could it be life-affirming? I didn't know. So if you don't know, what do? You call the artist. And by the way, the reason why my class is called The Art of Listening, it's not because listening's an art. But because art has a way of teaching us so many lessons that words alone do not teach. So it's really the lessons that art give you in communication. Next slide. So this is, you know, the circle is perfection. It's totally perfect. However, we know that within perfection is imperfection. You can never have pure one-sidedness. Next. Rumi, my buddy, has the simplest way of expressing things. A butterfly needs two wings. You find one wing, it's gonna. If it wants to fly, it has to have another. You have perfection, you have imperfection. You have health, you have pathology. You have pathology, there must also be health. Next. When you look here, in contrast to the patient, who's imperfect, flawed, damaged, we have the models of perfection, like the supermodels. They're all smiling, they're all trim, they're good-looking, they're young. That's the symbol, that's what's radiated. Next. But really, I know through mentoring physicians, there's a lot, you know, of mistakes, traumas. I should have, I could have, if only. Underneath the white coat, there's a lot going on. Next. So the artist's statement continues that images like this tend to change our perceptions, our ideals, until finally they leave us looking around at the peeling paint on our own houses, our less than fit bodies, and it leaves us wanting. Perfection, I would submit, is overrated, and besides, I like dandelions. So the artist did a painting of perfection and imperfection. And is expressing himself in a really, literally, very graphic way. The journal mailed my art. I wrote this as a commentary in the medicine and the arts section of academic medicine. I written a number of commentaries for them on various paintings. And they sent it to the artist for his approval. Next. Oh, there'll be the one after this. The artist's statement continues, in the painting, Sams assumes the role of presenter, host, even tutor of the most revealing examination of the civilization that man has made for himself. Even tutor, so he's talking about Sam as being a presenter, leaning forward, a host, inviting you in, and even a tutor who has a lesson to teach. Next. Sam is not society's accepted definition of perfection. In spite of that, or perhaps because of that, he really does have an important message for everyone to hear. So he sees a vital role for his son, Sam. Next. And the message is, in writing the commentary, I came up with a few messages. For physicians, the take-home message was that just as we saw the painting, it's not focused on Sam. It's not just focused on the circle. It's not just focused on the landscape. The painting was focused on all and on the relationship between Sam, the landscape, and the orb. And just in the same way that the artist did that, medicine is not, we hear it described as patient-centered, disease-centered, physician-centered. It's relational. It's holistic. Holism means that the health and vitality and the well-being of the physician is important. It's not irrelevant. The health, well-being of the patient is irrelevant. It's all. It's about the practice, the profession. Medicine is the ultimate in holism, and we need to see it that way. And that's one lesson. The other lesson, I'll just read this to you. For physicians, the take-home, the methods to take home this message, the method in which facts are instilled in medical students and physicians allows Sam to become disposable. An it. He's an it. He's a patient. He's a Down syndrome. And a nightmare of imperfection. While we physicians hide our flaws, our vulnerabilities behind crisp white coats, the very model of perfection. Holistic practice requires that we embrace our imperfections and acknowledge our humanity. Next. So this is where the journal sent the commentary to the artist, and he wrote to me, "My copy of Academic Medicine arrived in the mail today. Thank you so much for your beautiful, insightful comments. I love what you wrote. I was particularly interested with the comparison of the sun to an ovum, both yielding life, and the point you made in the last paragraph, which I just read, was especially poignant and well written. I could not agree with you more. Of all the different places my painting has been reproduced in the last few months, the inclusion of it in Academic Medicine, along with your perceptive comments, must be the most unexpected and perhaps the most satisfying for me. As you can tell, the reaction of doctors and nurses in the delivery room made a deep and lasting negative impression on me." So what is he saying? He's saying, A, that I was traumatized in that delivery room, in that operating room, I think in this, I was told something that is etched in my mind. What a nightmare. Are you going to keep it? Those comments are traumatic. Not the trauma of seeing that the child that you, you know, have hoped for, expected to be healthy, has Down syndrome is trauma enough. What added to the trauma were the comments. And it's possible that he could accept that the child has Down syndrome, but difficult to accept those words that made it particularly traumatic. Now, this is why I gave you the theory beforehand. This is a lament. People lament the way they express their suffering in the ways that they are used to expressing their suffering. People who are musicians, what will they do? They'll sing the blues. People who are preachers will preach something. People who are poets will write it in poetry. Artists will paint it. And he painted his lament, his expression of suffering. What did I do? I listened. I listened to the painting. I used all my senses, not just my hearing. I didn't use my hearing, in fact. I used my eyes. I used my intuition. I listened to the lament in the painting. And then I validated it through my writing. And I published it in a journal so that physicians, the medical community, can read about it. And consequently, the artist's lament was heard and understood, and particularly, in particular, was validated. Now, here's the interesting thing. When you listen, and listen really carefully, you can hear things that possibly the speaker doesn't even realize they're saying. And you can come back with an insight that can even create an aha in the person who you would think would be the one who knows it. So these comments helped him to understand himself a little bit better. And so this is an example of listening. Does everybody get that?
Yep.
It's listening without hearing words, but listening using all my senses, using eyes in this particular case. Next. So he said Sam has a message. Sam is a teacher, and Sam has a message. If you want to hear Sam's message, this was my message. What's Sam's message? Fence is very important. Sam is kept out. Great point. He's imperfect and he's kept out from the world that's perfect.
I think he's saying I'm very lonely.
And he's saying I'm lonely. And he is, in fact, isolated. So I wanted to hear Sam's message. Next slide. So we heard about a workshop being given by the Keystone Multimedia outfit. It was offered at the Pennsylvania Foundation in State College, Pennsylvania, for journalists newspaper reporters. So I joined the world of chaplaincy, the world of therapists. Why not join the world of newspaper reporters? And we did this workshop. We went to State College, and we learned over 3 days how to use digital media, how to use video cams and do tape recordings and interview people and create articles. Next. There I am. In the photographer's little golf cart, next. All the equipment they had that we could use if we signed out on it, next. We're being taught by Kurt and Susan, and I forget who that is, how to use a little video camera, next. Goldie receiving instruction in the lab, next. On our way to State College, look what we drive past. That's the scenery on the way. So something's telling me that, you know, maybe I'm going to the right place. There's no weed on the barbed wire, but there's even that little house in the background and the fence. No Sam. So I'm getting a little signal here from the cosmos. The workshop begins by them having Nicole, I forget her last name, who's from the Special Olympics, because this is a weekend of the Special Olympics. And why do I go? Because obviously there are going to be plenty of people with Down syndrome, their family members, and maybe I'll get a message from them. I want to know what can I learn from people with intellectual disabilities. So we're at the beginning of the workshop, Nicole comes, does a PowerPoint presentation, welcomes us, and reminds us that it's the 40th anniversary of the Special Olympics. It started small, has ended up being in 140 countries, even Afghanistan, she told us. 3 million athletes, innumerable trainers, coaches, and people who are volunteers involved. Who started it all? Anybody know? Eunice Shriver started it. And Congress, because of the 40th anniversary, commissioned a painting of Eunice Shriver. It's the only time Congress has done that of a non-president. Right? The only time was this, because all the other portraits commissioned by Congress were of presidents. It's just somebody leaving. That's okay. So let's look, next slide. Eunice Kennedy Shriver. Wow. Am I getting signals here that I'm in the right place? They commissioned David Lentz to do a portrait of Eunice Shriver with some of the superheroes of the Special Olympics. Each one is a superhero. That little girl saved her mother's life when she was like 2, and her mother had collapsed in, I think, hypoglycemic attack. She called 911 or some ridiculous age and saved her life. Each one is a superhero, and there is Eunice Shriver with these athletes, and each one is a Special Olympic athlete. And how does this relate to the painting? You know, with holism, everything relates to everything else.
It's the same
orb. There's the orb, but notice the orb is lower. It's not fully complete. What else?
Well, it has this reach back. It has this perception of reach.
All converging, yes. Where's the fence?
Gone.
Where's the isolation? Gone. Where's the puzzled expression? Gone. They really are, and that little kid is happy. And she's reaching towards perfection. She's not shying away from it or separated by a fence. And it's dark on the one side, but look, there's light emerging. Do you have a comment? It's not Sam, but it's somebody else with Down who, and it is not Sam. Notice the man. Now, the Special Olympics, by the way, is not a kid's thing. It's for all ages. So the man second from the left, we just notice him. Let's move to the next slide. So here's David Lentz is right there in the far left. And here he is with his painting, Eunice Shriver, who actually died that year. And these are the subjects that he painted. When I saw this, I knew I was at the right place. This was, to me, quite mystical. Next. So here's the Special Olympics. Amazing amount of atmosphere and joy and participation. And we'll just go through these quickly. Next. I wish you could hear them, but playing Sousa. Next. These are volunteers. Now, State College got into trouble, right? I mean, real bad trouble, which is ironic, because when I was there preceding that, this was such a safe place. Such a safe place for participants. And the girl right in the center, these were from the high school volunteers. The girl in the center, I asked her, what do you do besides play in the band? She said, I make the beds in a dormitory. And don't worry, I'm normal. I don't make my own bed. But this is what I do this weekend. Next. School teachers, it was security, and they said, this is just the thing we do at school anyway. It's just easier here. Next. I don't know his name, but he's there with his mother. Notice his leg. Next. He had an open fracture of his leg a few months before. He said, the thing that kept me going was knowing I'm going to the Special Olympics, and I was determined to get there. Next. That's the mother, that's the son. The father died weeks earlier. What kept them going? We're going to the Olympics. We're bringing father with us emotionally, spiritually. Next. That little girl, absolutely adorable. She has Down syndrome. She's been carried by the Penn State jock. Over here, looking at her cell phone or whatever, or camera, is her 12-year-old sister. Next. Close-up. Next. Stadium. Energy is fantastic. Next. 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 I've taken all these snapshots. Continue. I mean, look at those biceps. Can any... I mean, I've got things. I couldn't take my eyes off this guy, you know, I'm pretty straight. Next. Of course, the military gets involved. How does the military get involved? I don't know. It's part of our society. Next. Volunteers of all types. Continue. Next. A lot of horse riding gives them, it's a phenomenal empowerment to be on a horse, even people who can't ride or can't walk can be on a horse and are liberated from a wheelchair. Continue. This mother was telling me that her son, she had been told her son would never walk. Well, now, not only after surgery and a tremendous amount of persistence, could he walk, run, he could also ride horse. Continue. Continue. Again. Very sad story. The coach is in the center. He's the father of this young man. And his first son had Asperger's. His second son had autism. And this is the son with autism who would not be interviewed. He couldn't speak. Next. He was determined to cross. I mean, look at the expression of determination. And he did make it to the finish line. Next. Next. Some couldn't go forward because their legs were sticking out and they couldn't freak, so they went backwards. Big deal. And he won. Continue. The young man on the right, he used to be in the Special Olympics. Now he's a coach. Continue. He said, I'm happy. I have my home. I have a job. I'm a coach. Life is good. Continue. At night, there was, this weekend is theirs. This weekend is for them to enjoy. And no drugs, no alcohol. Just a really good time. Continue. Goldie in the background there filming it. Continue. And here's Aaron and Amy. Their mother told me that she knew that Amy had Downs before she delivered and was given an option of terminating pregnancy. And she was also told that she had a heart condition. No sweat, she said, I'm going to have her. And it's really an extraordinary, lovely family. So my take-home message, and there were lots, and I don't want to go on about it, but they're all dealing with not only intellectual disabilities, but physical disabilities. And what I saw there was this courage, this cooperation, this spirit, and the fact that there was so much health in that environment. Sure, there was pathology, but there was also health. And it was a really powerful experience. So I come home and I publish this. And by the way, I have some articles here you can take. I published this. I was going to publish this in Physicians News Digest. And I discovered that somehow, when using the lab, my thumb drive or whatever, the data got screwed up. I couldn't get the pictures. I couldn't get my writing. Gone. Disappeared. And I thought, this is terrible. I mean, I lost everything. The weekend is gone. What was the lesson? The lesson was persist. Don't give up. Now, technologically, I was beyond disabled. But I persisted. I said, somewhere, the information is there. I got to find it. And I did find it. I found it in some obscure file of recently changed documents. And I did publish the article. But the lesson I got was just don't give up, persist. There was another lesson that was very specific and related to Sam's case. When we break bad news, we think, if it was me, it would be terrible news, so I better just break it in a way that is natural to me. Well, what the mother said to me is, we are not the sufferers. It's the kids that are the sufferers. And you don't know how much we can handle and how much we can take. Just tell us what the news is. Don't lay on us. Don't project onto us how tough it is. Right? So I've got a really good lesson. I'll put this in the subsequent article in Physician News Digest. Next. But it didn't end there. You would think it would end there. Continue. I'm at Chautauqua, of all places, staying at the ECOC house. Downstairs is a communal kitchen. Look at those pictures that this woman's looking at. Irene Leonard. She's got the picture of David Lentz's painting. And she's got many copies of it. Why? Continue. Her husband had died. He was a clergyman. And she had 4 adopted children and 3 biological children. Her 4 adopted children were Andy from Vietnam, 42 years old with intellectual disability. He was in David Lentz's painting, the one I said second from the left. Joy from Korea, 37 years old. She was fine. Joshua, Korea, physically abused and cleft palate. Mary Ellen, neglected behavior problems, plus 3 biological children. She had the strength and the will and the ability to not only to consciously choose to take people, adopt children with disabilities. Next. There I am with her and her Korean daughter. Next. So a year later, we're in Wisconsin. I'm giving a workshop for chaplains at a chaplaincy conference in the Midwest. And we're in this fabulous art museum in Wisconsin, in Madison, and we see the painting. And so the security guard comes up to me and says, "Do you know about this painting? I'll tell you all about it." Continue. And this is a close-up. Look at the detail. Incredible detail. It's hard to believe it's not a photograph. Next. And we stop at the State House. We're tourists, right? Speak to this man, and he asks, "What did you see here?" I said, "Well, one of the interesting, exciting things was to see this painting." He said, "Oh, yes, my daughter tutored Sam." Continue. In Washington, we see the actual painting of the second painting. Continue. And it's much better in the flesh than in print, believe it or not. No matter how good the print, when you see the actual painting next, look at the detail. Look at the light shining through her fingers. And you see the blood flow in her fingers. And her hair feels soft. I mean, just looking at it, it feels soft. It's a marvelous experience. And what did this tell me? That there's sort of an ultimate irony here. The father is a perfectionist. He's a total, absolute perfectionist. And he has a son that's imperfect. And there's sort of an ultimate irony in how he comes to terms with imperfection. How this particular artist comes to terms with imperfection. Next. So it raises, this presentation raises questions for me, and maybe we can discuss them, and any other questions or thoughts that might have occurred to you that you've been very patiently holding on to. We'll get to that. So the question that comes to me is, with this issue of perfection and imperfection, we're part of society. We can't help but be influenced by society. So to what extent do we value perfection, so-called perfection, and devalue what is so-called imperfection? Obesity, the elderly, people with disabilities, perhaps helping at the checkout and being a little bit slow. Things in society that we see are imperfect, or people in particular, how does this influence us in the way we approach them? Do we see the health as well as the imperfection? And the other thing is, what about in ourselves? What do we do about the imperfections in ourselves? How do we treat ourselves when we see what we perceive of as imperfection? So I think that this painting raises many questions just in that area alone, apart from the other stuff of communication that I was talking about. So, questions. I think your hand was up first, and let's have a bit of a discussion.
Let me just explain how we're going to handle this. We've got two mics here. Lou Altman's going to be on the other mic, and we will be roaming around. We will try to take you in the order that you raise your hand. So did we see a first hand?
And it's comments as well as questions, so feel free to.
And anyone else want to be next?
I just wondered. I just wondered what the medium was of the painting.
Oil
acrylic.
Oil painting.
I'm Ellie Altman. I have a friend who works with horses and their therapy horses, and they help disabled people, and they can read. They can actually read the problems of the people that are working with them, and they're trained. I mean, it's a remarkable. They're trained to work with disabled people. And
who is trained? Horses.
The horses are trained.
Yes.
And they're therapy horses.
Yes. Fantastic. Yeah.
Barry? Did the panel that shows that painting of Sam as the first choice,
yes,
did they know the whole story behind the painting in evaluating whether to give it the first award, or did they just select it based on viewing it?
Fascinating question. I have no idea how they made the jury made the selection. I presume they read the artist statement, which helped them interpret. I can only think it happened in that order. Yeah, because it was, I think when you submit a painting, you have to submit an artist statement, and I'm pretty sure that was part of it.
Yeah, because the whole background makes, it adds so much to the painting, given your whole narrative. It's fascinating, really.
And, you know, there are two schools of thoughts. One is, does a painting stand on its own merit or photograph, or do you experience it in context with the narrative? In this case, you couldn't possibly kind of get to the depth of it without having the artist statement.
Next question is here.
As a gestaltist, when you work with physicians groups in helping them develop their listening skills, what techniques do you use and how intensive is it?
So what I found, and let me be real clear, with the onslaught of the medical record, the electronic medical record, with the onslaught of this health insurance business that's going on, with the 60,000 diagnostic codes that physicians now have to research, with the whole focus on technology, I've decided that my time is much better spent teaching this to the consumer than it is to the practitioner. Because there's the rare practitioner who is open to learning more about self-patient relationship. It's the rare one. And often what the breakthrough to realizing, aha, there is something more to the practice of medicine than rushing from room to room, so there's something more. And what is the breakthrough? When the physician himself or herself is traumatized. Trauma has a way of shocking you into a new reality. And sometimes there's an opening. And so what I would do with my physician mentoring is when somebody sued, devastated, and let's say the spouse would call me or pressure them into contacting me, and I would work with them. I would help them make meaning of the experience. 4 years of litigation is really tough. It's soul-destroying. There's no value in it. And if they feel that injustice has been created, it's just really dispiriting. And what I would do through mentoring is validate the physician's lament, validate the physician's suffering. And I do that in my book as well, Communication Skills That Heal. It's geared to healing the practitioner, not just the patient. That's why I chose that title. I validate the suffering of the practitioner, and then I say, if you want to have meaning out of this 4 years excruciating experience, why not learn something new that will change your life for the rest of your life? And what is it? Learn communication skills that you can apply right away. And when your patients and your staff begin to smile at you and touch you and bring you cakes and, whatever, you are going to get a positive affirmation that's going to lift your spirit more than anything else. And find meaning in this experience. And then there's a breakthrough. But if you take this to a physician group and try and teach it, maybe one in a room with this number of people will light up and say, wow, I can use this. I don't know, whoever.
Yeah, I once heard a sermon by a Unitarian minister on the subject of listening, and I found out I'd been doing it all wrong my whole life. Let's say somebody, a friend tells me I have asthma. My tendency would be to say, to relate it to my own experience and say, oh, my father had asthma too. Okay, but that's not what the person wants to hear. And I didn't realize that, that I'm getting into my own self. And that what they, I think, really want to hear is, well, tell me how it affects your life. To keep the focus on the person who's talking. So I really learned a lot about that. So could you give us a quick summary of how to listen? When somebody has a complaint?
So one of the ways of getting through to the medical profession is to teach how to listen better rather than longer. Listen better. Every patient is a sufferer. So look for the suffering. Don't wait for it to drop on your lap. It's there. So when you hear it, and even when you don't hear it, recognize it's going to be there. Anybody who comes in having lost a leg is suffering. Don't wait for them to say it's tough to play golf. Ask them, you know, you love golf. You've lost a leg. How are you going to manage? You know, that shows empathy. That recognizes. Don't ever say, oh, you must be suffering. That's not the way to go. But you can, through your questioning or comments. But this is step number one. Step number one is recognize your own suffering first. If you don't validate yourself, if you go in, as a physician, you walk into an exam room feeling exhausted, wiped out, tired, and thinking, oh, you know, she's a nudge, this person here. I don't want to see this patient. But I have to think of that outside the room. Acknowledge it, validate it, saying, okay, I don't like being with this person, and it's tough, and I appreciate myself for doing it. Take a deep breath, and then transition into the room using your eyes, your ears, and every sense to listen right away. The first organ you use when you enter a room are your eyes, before anything's been expressed. What do you notice? It's all about awareness, right? But then, awareness, as we all know, you have to be in the present. You cannot be aware in the future. You cannot be aware in the past. So if you walk into a place thinking about other things, your own suffering or what you have to do or what you should do, you're never going to be present enough to listen. So this is the foundation. Foundation is validate your own suffering. Recognize it. Let your own suffering get out of the way and be fully present in the here and now. Totally focused in the here and now. Right? Not easy.
There are two things that I got from your presentation.
Only two? Mark, we're going to have a discussion.
Yeah. One is, I recollect a number of years ago, a friend of mine had a grandchild born to his son and daughter-in-law. The daughter-in-law was also a physician. He was a perfectionist economist. And we discussed the issue of the birth of this child who evidently had Down syndrome. And the discussion was, did she have genetic testing prior to having this?
Okay.
So yeah. The answer to that question from my colleague was no, she did not. And even if she did, she would not have terminated the pregnancy because of her religious beliefs. Yeah. I thought, well, there's some tragedy here. But as a result of your discussion, I realized, well, maybe that's not a tragedy. That they did have the child, and they were traumatized for a year after that. The second thing I had learned is, what about the unheard of about patient? What are they thinking? This child.
Yes.
I would like to know what they're thinking, what their impressions are of life. That's the missing piece.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that you can, how can one generalize what one person thinks about life compared to another, whether you're disabled or not disabled? I will say that that people with Down syndrome in particular tend to bring happiness. It's who knows how or why, but what I've heard from family members is when Sam enters the room, or Lior, did you see the movie Praying with Lior? He lived in Philadelphia. He still lives in Philadelphia. He had a bar mitzvah, and he's 13, and he prays very fervently, brings light into the room. People enjoy speaking with him, and I think anybody who finds other people who like them feel positively affirmed.
Anybody? Okay.
There, go to on that side. Yeah.
Could your program be taught to medical students, if not to the doctors? How about the medical students?
I at Temple, I work in a volunteer medical clinic, and we have third-year medical students. Here are a few facts. It's really disheartening. There's such tremendous corruption in medicine. Here's my own lament. Anybody hear it?
Yeah.
Right. So you could say this whole presentation's a lament. Third-year medical students, a recent survey, 50% suffer from burnout. 10% have suicidal ideation. Do you think anything changes? No. There are 4 years of cram all this information in order to become a doctor, get stuffed with information, then another, 4 years pre-med, 4 years of medicine, huge bills, then 3 years of training, there may be post-fellowship training. It can take up to 14 years. If you want to be a listener, if you want to listen, you have to be able to listen to yourself. You have to be present in the here and now, not be running all the time. And so the whole system is geared, and it's nothing to do with whether you're empathetic, born empathetic, and the focus still is on choosing the right candidates, the most empathetic, the most sensitive, smart student will be selected. How do we select better students to be doctors? Well, it's not what you do when you select them as much as what you do to them once you got them. So it's a problem.
I believe that when you started, you said your daughter encouraged you to see this painting?
Yes, she had heard of it, and because I lived near Washington and she didn't, she suggested I see it.
So she hadn't seen it?
She had not, maybe a picture. She must have seen a picture of it, or I'm not sure how she heard of it.
So did you have a discussion with her about
it? Oh, we have had lots and lots and lots of discussions, and she's become a very amazing presenter and teacher, and for the reason that you will go beyond the surface, yeah.
Anybody else? We've got one back here.
The first thing I noticed about the painting, which also stays with me now, is that this representation of this orb in the sky is actually an unnatural-looking phenomena.
Yes.
It's supposed to be perfection, but it's actually quite unnatural, which is not perfection in a way.
What do you mean by unnatural?
Have you seen a sky that looks like that? The sun looking like that, it looks surreal.
Whereas the
rest of the painting is absolute realism of the highest
contrast
degree.
Between the two. Yeah.
So there's something really odd about this representation of perfection. It's in a way imperfect.
Beautiful comment. And any time you see religious art from that era where you see all, halos, I taught a class on halos. It's fascinating. They used to be solid halos, and it looked like the people sitting around like the Last Supper, not the Last Supper, but where saints were collected around a banquet table. It looks like they're banging their plates into each other. Then they made them with just the rim on the outside so that they didn't have the clash of halos. The whole concept is unnatural. Something. Somebody's objecting from up there. Yeah.
Anybody else want to make a comment? Looks like we've reached a point here. Remember that DeBerry had some handouts on the piano over there, some articles that he'll be over by there, can direct you to that. We want to thank you all for coming. We will have another session 2 weeks from today, so hope you'll join us then.
Thank you very much.